Why is sexual harassment so pervasive and so hard to address? Let's interrogate the whole system.
Hi, my name is Jodi Kantor. I'm an investigative reporter for the New York Times.
What have you got?
I was told that the wrongdoing in Hollywood is overwhelming.
I don't want to be quoted. Period.
Understood.
In your previous stories,
how did you persuade women to tell you what had happened to them?
A case I made was, I can't change what happened to you in the past.
But together we may be able
to help protect other people.
The truth, basically.
What is it exactly that we're looking at here?
These young women walked into what they all had reason to believe were business meetings.
I can still see it, the hotel room, the floor plan.
He kept trying to touch me.
I asked him to leave me alone.
Instead, they say he met them with threats and sexual demands.
I was young, scared.
Hi, we're from the New York Times. I believe you used to work for Harvey Weinstein.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard criminal behaviour analyst and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, writer, producer, Criminal Minds, and also host of the podcast Best Case, Worst Case. And we also have...
I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm a casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and the host of the podcast Killer Casting. But I'm really honored to be on the advisory board for an organization called Hire Survivors Hollywood that we're going to talk about shortly. But speaking of casting, you know, I've cast, Jim and Laura, as you know, many roles of victims and survivors of every kind of crime. But It is a special responsibility and honor when you're casting roles based on real people and real events. And we have today two very special guests that I've come to know, one as an actor who is herself a survivor of a terrible assault and whose work you can see in the Universal film She Said. And our other guest is an extraordinary activist whose own story is depicted. And for my money, I think it's actually the heart of the film She Said. And so I'm so excited to have everybody meet these two incredible, incredible people today. And I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sarah Ann Massey. I'm an actor, writer, producer, comedian, singer. One of the first people to come forward about Harvey Weinstein. And I'm also the founder of an organization called Hire Survivors Hollywood.
Awesome. And?
Hi, my name is Rowena Chu. I worked for Harvey Weinstein in 1998, and I was subsequently assaulted by him, signed an NDA that same year. After 20 years, my story came out in She Said, the book and the movie. And for the last few years, I've been working as an activist in the area of sexual assault, but particularly among Asian sexual assault survivors in the US and internationally.
Well, wow. Welcome to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for joining us today and having such an important discussion. And yes, I watched the movie. Incredible. You could hear a pin drop here in Los Angeles. I was up in Hollywood. It was just incredible to see it portrayed on the big screen. And I read the book, Jodi and Megan's book, and also Ronan Farrow's Catch and Kill. And my goodness, I mean, 20 years, Rowena, and you come forward. And I read a brilliant article, actually, that you wrote in the New York Times, where you talk about the slower process of, well, actually, it was quite quick, of what Weinstein was doing immediately when he met you, of the boundary pushing and the grooming. And oftentimes people don't think about that, the grooming and the boundary pushing that can start on the first meeting. Can you just say a little bit about that? Because I think it's really helpful for our listeners to understand that oftentimes these behaviors are in full sight of everybody and they're missed and they're not understood.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I'd like to think that the film industry was quite a different place in the 90s. But as I've discussed with other assistants that were assaulted in a similar time frame, we talk about how, well, in the 90s, it wasn't like you could walk down the street and go and find somebody else to work for who was far better behaved. You know, Harvey certainly had a reputation. At the same time, you know, among female assistants, it was openly discussed in pubs and bars that you couldn't go and work for anyone where you didn't have to defend yourself. And when I look back at that and I think about my two daughters who are 13 and 11, do I want to send them in a workplace where it's just accepted that young women have to defend themselves as just a way, you know, that's just part of your daily work? And so when I did the original interview for Harvey, it was, you know, really made clear that he was a difficult person to work with, that he had anger issues, that he was likely to just be impossible to handle. And whilst it wasn't made clear what kind of difficulty there would be, I think there was an implicit assumption that he would have wandering hands, that he would have a legendary temper, that he would abuse his assistants, both male and female. And so looking back on that, it's both shocking that that was an accepted situation and also not that shocking if you think of the fact that 20 years later, you know, there are still problems within Hollywood today and other industries. And these are the things that we attempt to uncover with the work that both Sarah Ann and I are doing.
That's awesome.
You described your first meeting with Weinstein and that you were going to sit in front of him in a movie theater and you didn't want to block his view. So you were trying to be polite and he shouted at you and he cursed at you. And in that moment, it was sort of a boundary test to see whether you were compliant or non-compliant. And I think that first interaction is actually very instructive. And you mentioned that your gut was telling you big problem, red flag, and you wish you had walked away then. I think that gut instinct that we have, that sometimes women, we push it down and we rationalize it and we minimize it. Can you just say a little bit about that too? Because it's really important that we empower people to act on their instincts, isn't it? When they see a red flag and not to leave something.
Yeah. Well, I think one interesting thing that is rarely discussed outside of Harvey's behaviour, when I went to work for Miramax in London, it was predominantly young women who worked in the office, and they all are bright and beautiful and accomplished, and I was in awe of almost all of them. But they all, without exception, even the more senior women in the office, would say, well, when Harvey comes, make sure you do exactly what he says. It's very difficult to make him happy. You know, it was all a cat on a hot tin roof. Everybody was jumping around trying to make sure that when Harvey came over from the US, you know, we did everything we could to keep him happy. And even on the way to the screening room, you know, I was there with Zelda Perkins and also Judy Goldstein, who was a producer for Shakespeare in Love. And both of them were saying, you're going to do absolutely fine. Just make sure that you do exactly as he says. If he tells you to sit in front of him, do exactly that. So that I think that there's a process of, it's not deliberate, but there's an inadvertent grooming and a passing of the baton on other women in the office. And I think that is a very difficult topic to discuss, because I know that we as a group of assistants have been accused of being complicit. We've been accused of knowing much more than we did. But frankly, in those days, in the late 90s, we were all just trying to survive. We were all young women who came from good universities, who could have been doing better somewhere else, who could have been paid to be doing other work. But we all had a passion for film. So we made barely any money and we were sort of all in it together. And I think that's very difficult, because you get caught in a web where you admire the people that you're working with, the other women, and you think they survived and they are doing great things in film. And so all you got to do is roll with the punches, as another assistant told me.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds a lot like very analogous to what Glenn Maxwell did with respect to Epstein. I mean, it's sort of an insidious parallel, and it may not have been as deliberate on their part, but the senior people that had been there for a while, but it was probably part of, as you said, part of survival for them. And unfortunately, the way the career system is set up, if you make noise, if you become, quote, a problem, or you don't follow the rules, then you don't have a career.
You don't have a job by the very next day, that same day. And we saw people being fired all the time from Miramax. They rarely worked again. And frankly, when Zelda and I did make a fuss, we also never worked in film again.
Right. And I want to turn back to that NDA that they made you sign. But I want to pivot to Sarah Ann, because you also had a job interview with HW and in a very different context. Can you share your story?
Yeah, well, ironically, similar to Rowena, I also experienced grooming. Prior to actually meeting Harvey, I was an actor living in New York, and my day job had always been to be a nanny. So I was working with a nannying agency, and they told me that there was this job they thought I'd be good for because the person worked in the entertainment industry. And I had also worked for higher profile clients in the past. And I found out it was Harvey Weinstein. And at the time, I didn't know anything about him. I know there's this narrative that everybody knew, and it was this open secret. But I think as a young actress who was coming from theater and really wasn't in the film and TV world yet, I had not heard anything. I had sort of heard some rumblings that he might be difficult as a boss, you know, but a lot of people are. And I had certainly had the experience that working as a nanny, you're sort of more this pseudo family member, and it's not the same dynamic as when you're working in an office with a person. So I felt confident going in, and I had several meetings with his assistants prior to meeting him. They were young women, a little older than me, but clearly very bright, like Rowena said, and accomplished. And I didn't realize at the time, but they were, I think probably inadvertently, grooming me to be prepared to take what I was going to experience at my interview. They talked a lot about discretion. And at the time, I thought they were, you know, sort of implying, well, there's going to be around when there's parties, and maybe this famous person has a little too much to drink, and we don't want you taking pictures to sell to the tabloids. It's like, fine, that makes sense. Of course, you're going to be discreet in terms of that. What I didn't realize is that they were preparing me to be sexually assaulted. And there was even a little bit of a bait and switch where one of the assistants was supposed to be there with me at the interview. And late the night before, she said, oh, I'm not able to be there, so tell me how it goes after. And I was going to his home in Connecticut. I lived in New York. I had to cross state lines to go to this interview. And it's not unusual. As a nanny, you are almost always interviewing at the person's home. Mm-hmm. So again, I didn't feel there were any red flags. I wasn't afraid. But I drove up, and he lived on this essentially a compound in Connecticut. And you have to drive up this driveway that's like a mile away from anyone else once you get to the house, and you're locked behind a gate. And then you go up to the house, and he opened the door in his underwear. And that was the first time. That was the first time I went, something's wrong. But your brain, I mean, again, I was very young, and your brain sort of tries to make sense of something that doesn't make sense. And so I thought, oh, how embarrassing. It's a weekend. He forgot he had this interview. I'm sure he'll go excuse himself. And so I walk into the house thinking it's all going to be okay. And once I'm locked behind that door, I realize he's not changing. He's not doing anything. He's bringing me into this interview and conducting this professional interview in his underwear.
Wow.
You know, I luckily sat across the room from him. Like, it was, my instinct was to like put distance between us. And I think that, I don't know, helped in some way, but he proceeded to sexually harass me, to explode with rage. I thought we were alone at first, and I was very scared, but his children came in. And he screamed at them. He went from being like attempting to be charming and polite and whatever in his manner to just this explosion of anger. And it was that moment that I became really afraid for myself, like afraid for my safety. And he told them that they couldn't stay in the room, that they had to leave. Don't come back in as long as I'm here. We have to be alone. And I have no escape. I'm locked behind a gate. I'm locked behind a door. I have nowhere to run to. So I just have to sort of sit there and hope it doesn't continue to get worse and worse. And it did. He, you know, he assaulted me. I froze. It was just bad. It was terrible. It was awful. It is so similar to what so many other people have gone through, you know, whether it be a hotel room or an office or a house, whether it's underwear or a robe or nothing. It's like, it's the same pattern. And you know, I've met a lot of assistants over the years now who worked for Harvey. I know Rowena very well. And I don't think that ultimately these assistants were complicit in the sense that we talked, like you had mentioned Ghislaine Maxwell. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was that. I can only assume that so many of them were being abused themselves, were just trying to get through their day, trying to keep their job. I don't have any ill will against them. I do think it was part of the whole scheme in order to get women alone with him. But it is complicated. And ultimately, the people with the power, I think, are the people who are most responsible for
it. Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's no question about that. And I can totally relate to your experience in that. I was victimized when I was a teenager. And, you know, it was a similar set of circumstances. I was in a camp 60 miles away from home on, like, I don't know, 900 acres, you know, we were the only ones there. There was no way to get out of there. And you're trapped. You're literally trapped. So I'm really sorry that you went through that. And Rowena, I'm really sorry that you went through what you went through. but it is exactly the same. You know, it's very analogous, that whole grooming process. It takes different forms. And part of it is the power of that person in the profession. It's something that, you know, you have a lot of passion for, you really wanted to do, you were trying to do the right thing. And you would think that in an interview where you were being interviewed ostensibly to care for these children, that any interaction with the children would have been encouraged. But so clearly there was no intent on his part to get a good nanny for his children. There was absolutely no intent. And I have to say that it looks very suspicious that he probably got rid of the colleague that was supposed to be there with you. He probably did that deliberately. He probably ordered her not to be there. So this is all, it's all a setup. And it's just terrible that, unfortunately, it's so difficult to overcome the professional issues and stigma just by being honest, just by telling the truth. You're still going to be stigmatized. You're still going to risk your profession.
I think the points that Sarah Ann raises about the complicity of assistants is very interesting. I think what a lot of people who criticize the assistants often forget is there's this enormous power differential between someone like Harvey Weinstein and somebody who is 23, 24, has no name in Hollywood, is literally just starting out, could possibly not have a job in the next hour. And so as assistants, we're all also frightened. We're all equally being abused. We are all told that we have to absolutely keep Harvey happy, or we won't have a job tomorrow, that we might be putting ourselves at risk as well. And I think a lot of us, we don't know what's going on. I've been asked, well, the actresses that you and Zelda brought up to the room for auditions, you know, weren't you aware that you were putting them in a difficult situation? Zelda has often been asked, was she aware that she was putting me in a difficult situation? I didn't interview thinking that I was going to be sexually assaulted on a daily basis. I don't believe that Zelda Perkins hired me thinking that I was going to be sexually assaulted on a daily basis. Look at the way that she immediately reacted once I went to her. This was a person acting out of shock and horror, a moral outrage. She was brave enough, given her power differential, to go and confront Harvey immediately. You know, in the issue of discussing the complicity of assistants, I think it's often overlooked that we have this huge power differential. And I think that this issue of blaming assistants for what they knew or didn't know is a really tricky minefield.
It's co-victimization. And this is something, you know, we talk about this with sexual victimization of children. When I was victimized, I had no idea that other boys at the camp were being victimized. I didn't know that this had been a long-term history. I knew nothing about this. And this was something, a very unique experience to me. And this is something that victims suffer. And you can tell me whether either of you thought this, but I take the blame of what happened to me. Absolutely. I felt shame. I felt guilt. I felt like I couldn't say anything. I felt I was somehow in the wrong. And that's part of what grooming does to you. Grooming puts you in a situation where you want something that's legitimate and good and healthy. And your aim is for that. You're focusing on that. You don't want to give up your dreams and your life and the respect you might have for this person by convincing yourself how wrong it all is. So I don't know if your experience was the same, but that's how I experienced it. I just didn't know that there were other victims and was very surprised later to find out there were 247.
I always say that the first New York Times piece that came out was the first time I realized I wasn't alone, that this, I wasn't the only person who had gone through this. I spent almost a decade thinking that he had targeted me for some reason and I could never talk about it, that my life and my career would be over if I did. And then I think there's 111 women now who have gone on the record.
Yeah. And that's what he's counting on, Sarah Ann, as you know, he's counting on that silence. And I think critics who lay the blame at the feet of the assistants, it's just disgusting and absurd when there are far more powerful enablers who protected him, who continue to protect him. And I think, you know, some listeners may be listening and kind of rolling their eyes like, well, this just happens in Hollywood and everyone in Hollywood is shite. No. And you know, this is part of the tax of doing business in this industry, isn't it? But, you know, I think that that's the wrong lesson to learn here. And I think when you have anyone in any industry who makes others successful, right? Think about all of those Academy Award winning actors and producers and directors. I mean, I looked this up and Harvey Weinstein was thanked more than God in acceptance speeches from 1966 to like 2015.
Staggering.
I mean, when you have somebody who is elevating others and who others are depending on, it's a very dangerous situation.
It's a pillar of the community offender. I mean, it's just, it's somebody who everybody looks up to. It's very, very difficult to overcome that incredible public image. And so there's public grooming, grooming of the community, as well as of the victims.
Well, let's talk about the power imbalance a bit more, because it's actually multifaceted, isn't it? It's not just about one thing. And, you know, to give another example, we're not just talking about Hollywood. Just yesterday, a police officer admitted in the Metropolitan Police Service to 80 plus sexual assaults against women, or of women, I should say, with at least 47 rapes. He was a serving police officer, and his nickname was Bastard Dave. All his colleagues knew him as that. And there were 9 previous complaints of women coming forward about him across his 17-year career. He was recruited and vetted despite 2 allegations of domestic violence. His name was David Carrick. He was in the same unit as a man called Wayne Cousins, who abducted, raped, and murdered Sarah Everard. Now, you know, I worked in the Metropolitan Police Service previously and at New Scotland Yard. These cases are not just there's one here, there's one there, and this is an anomaly. It's across the board, actually. And that's what I've seen across my career. And the power imbalance, the ecosystem, is what the problem is, not the assistants or even the junior colleagues. It's those who hold that power. And it's much like a coercive control spider's web, where you can become entrapped and exploited and dominated and isolated, and you don't have power. And in my experience, women don't hold that power in these male dominant industries. So when we hear a man described as difficult, it's actually quite different from when a woman's described as difficult. A man being described as difficult, most women know what that means. We don't know, as we're more experienced in life, we start to get a better understanding of it. But there is a gender issue here in the power imbalance, male, female, also someone being successful or being seen as senior in their career. It can also be about race. And I know, Rowena, you know, you talk a little bit about that, or I've heard you talk about that before. And I think that's a very important element too. It can also be about wealth and how someone holds power and then how they can muddy the waters. They can use a Darvo tactic and they're believed because of who they are over who you are as a more inexperienced or junior, but particularly female person. So I often wonder, how many women does it take, you know, to challenge one man? And we've seen with Cosby, we've seen with so many perpetrators, we're talking about many, many women, but it should really just be one woman who makes an allegation that we should believe and we should take seriously and we should investigate and we should ask critical questions about their behavior. But what we know is that oftentimes the women are shut down. They're seen as the problem. They receive some form of retaliation and they're silenced. And everyone looks at her behavior and not his. And I think Weinstein was very manipulative and clever at exploiting his power in that multifaceted way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in the case of Harvey, we actually have a numerical answer. It took at least 111 women because I actually think the women that are out are possibly the tip of the iceberg. We won't actually know how many women Harvey's assaulted, but we know numerically it's at least 111. It's taken 111 women to speak out against Harvey for him to be partially believed. If you look at the LA trial, the four people went up. Only really one of the four women were fully believed in terms of actually, you know, there's now going to be a verdict in that case. Others were acquitted or partially, you know, he was acquitted or partially. I mean, that's actually staggering, given that he already is serving a rape sentence in New York. And I think this issue of the kind of multifaceted web that we get drawn into is very interesting. I want to go back to a point that Jim raised about there's public grooming and there's private grooming. And to tie that in together and to give very specific examples, here was a guy who, even in the short time that I worked for him, I witnessed scream at people like De Niro and Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise. He screamed at people who were major A-listers in Hollywood. So in the back of my mind was always, well, if he can do this to major A-listers, what is he going to do to me, given how small I am, given my race, given my status, given all of the factors, all of the power imbalances that Laura spoke about? And then on the flip side of that, returning to a point that Sarah Ann made, you are constantly making excuses in your head. Zelda said something, oh, he's too important for trousers. And it made people laugh, but that's very much a thing of, we felt, you know, it echoes what Sarah Ann said about him coming to the door in his underwear. We thought, well, he's just a really important man who can scream at Steven Spielberg. So obviously he's just too important to put his trousers on. He can't be bothered with trifles like that. And so we're constantly excusing his behavior as well as being terrified of the immense power that he wields. And if you put that together, it becomes a really toxic equation.
And I want to mention, you know, I think that one thing that kept me silent for so long was this fear of retaliation. I lost time in my career anyway because I held myself back. I was so terrified by what had happened to me that I was afraid to put myself in that position again with another powerful man. Or God forbid, I went into an audition and Harvey was attached to the project. I was just so terrified. I lost a lot of time. But I finally started clawing my way back and getting progress in my career and making waves and getting to the point that I always wanted to be at. And I came forward, and for maybe about a month and a half, I had this groundswell of support that I felt. And that was great because I was so afraid and I had not talked to the press all the time prior to this. This was all very new for me. And then sure enough, about a month and a half in, I was told that I needed to stop. I told my story, enough is enough. My agent at the time told me that they were getting angry phone calls from casting directors, that I was going to blacklisted, that I was going to lose out on auditions. And this was my biggest fear. But I, in that moment, chose to think this is just my agent's fear presenting itself. I'm sure it's going to be okay. But it wasn't. All of my auditions dried up. The phone stopped ringing. I went from having six auditions a month to a little over six auditions in the past 5 years. And I think people think, because Harvey is behind bars, that it's fixed, that this is not an issue anymore. But what people don't understand is his power is still evident in our industry. Not only does he still have friends, but there are still abusers working in this industry. And there is still the sense of, oh, yeah, we all know what Harvey did was bad. But people like Sarah, she's difficult. She's a problem. I've heard from friends who are in writers' rooms, folks, you know, my name or other people's names come up and they go, oh, they're too political. They're too difficult. And I know, Lisa, you've spoken about this too. And so I just want to say, like, it's still happening. Those of us who have been abused, those of us who have been harmed already are still facing retaliation and, you know, economic harm and career impact, you know, not to mention the physical illness that comes on from all the trauma and the psychological and emotional damage. So it's something that needs to change, and it is changing. I mean, I've watched it change because I've been pushing for it to change with my organization, and we have gotten filmmakers to take our pledge and work to be inclusive of survivors and to create safer and more equitable work environments. People want to do it, and it's easy to do it, but it's like this shift that needs to happen in the general mindset of who the actual problem is. And it's not the people who speak up. It's not the people who complain. It's not the squeaky wheels. It's the people who are causing the harm in the first place. And it's interesting to me that 5 years on, we're still having to remind people of that.
the soft shunning is absolutely real. I've heard it. I've experienced it. And it's hard to litigate something like that. You know, it's hard to, it's just something you hear and you feel. And that's why I'm so glad that you did start Hire Survivors Hollywood. And Sarah, can you just tell everybody what you did for the movie She Said when it started to be casted, when it started casting? As we said, it was based on a book by two amazing journalists who really wrote a huge expose about Weinstein and his victims. And when it was turned into a film, what did you do?
Well, so I obviously was very aware of the reporting and I had read the book and I was very excited to find out that it was being made into a film. I feel like this is exactly the kind of story that needs to be told and that cinema has a way of reaching people's hearts that knocks down walls and lets people become empathetic. And I was really excited, but I saw the first casting announcement that Zoe Kazan and Carey Mulligan were playing the leads and I was thrilled. I thought they're so excellent as actors and they're going to bring so much empathy to these parts. But there was nothing in the release that I saw that indicated that they were going to be including any Weinstein survivors in the process. Now, it didn't mean they weren't going to, but I didn't know. So I thought, I better do something about this. And I called the Universal switchboard and I opened up IMDb and I just went down the list of executives until the person on the end of the switchboard said, oh yeah, we have an extension for this person. So the voicemail gave a cell phone number and email address for this exec. And I sent an email and I left a voicemail and I was not pitching myself as an actor. I said, hi, this is who I am. I'm a Weinstein survivor. I work in the industry. I started this initiative called Hire Survivors Hollywood. I feel like She Said is an excellent opportunity to put this work into action. I think this is a great opportunity for Universal. I'd love to have a conversation. And to their credit, within an hour, they wrote back to me.
That's amazing.
And said, this is great. I want to put you in touch with the right person. Took a couple of weeks. I ended up meeting with their sort of equity and inclusion department, two really great women. And I told them what the organization does and ideas for how I thought they could be inclusive of Weinstein survivors on this project and survivors in general at Universal. And I just felt gratified that I got that far, that I got to have the meeting. I thought, you know, it's the film's probably almost entirely cast. It's probably too late for this, but at least I said something. And then shortly after, I got an audition. And keep in mind, I wasn't getting many auditions at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was for Untitled Maria Schrader Project. I instantly knew what it was because I knew she was directing. And I felt really excited, obviously for myself, but I thought, if they're giving me an audition, I bet they're doing the thing of auditioning a bunch of Weinstein survivors. And it turns out they had. Francine Maisler and Dee Dee Gardner put together a list of people who they thought would be appropriate for the remaining roles. And they got a bunch. We had like 24 hours to turn around a self-tape. And all I knew was I was supposed to be a young, enthusiastic journalist. And I thought, I can do that. That's right. <my lab." laughs> And I did the best I could and I sent off my tape and I didn't expect anything. And then they booked me. They asked me to do the film. And it was great. And, you know, I ended up talking to Dee Dee and we sort of put together the pieces of how this all came to be. And they were already consulting, as far as I understand, with certain survivors who were depicted in the film in terms of developing the script. And they had a therapist that we could call at any time if we felt triggered. Wow. So we were putting, if you go to our website and look at our toolkit that I authored, they're doing a lot of the things that I'm encouraging filmmakers to do to create a safer work environment, to include survivors in the process. And the film turned out beautifully. I mean, what they did, and this is going to sound weird because I obviously was one of the people who was cast, but what they did was what you're supposed to do. They look at auditions, they pick the best person for the role. But the only difference was they opened a door that had previously been closed. They allowed people who were not getting opportunities to have the opportunity. It was never going to be that all of us were going to get cast. That's not how it works. But it meant that we got a fair shake. Right. And, you know, I happened to kind of look like Emily Steele and be right around the right age. You know, it just worked out for me on this one. And the next one, it might not. But hopefully it'll work out for another survivor. And that's the goal. And that's what we've experienced with all the filmmakers that we've teamed up with. We've gotten a lot of survivors work over the past couple of years and a lot of survivors auditions and interviews. And we've had intimacy coordinators hired. And this is people working on a $3,000 budget or $30 million budget. Like, this can be done at any sort of level within this industry. And it's really gratifying work.
Well, Rowena and Sarah Ann, wow, your stories are amazing and your dedication and commitment to this very, very worthy cause are just so exemplary. And we have so much more to talk about. And we're going to ask you to come back next week so we can continue our discussion. again, thank you so much for coming forward. Our hearts go out to you for what you had to go through and to the other victims of HW. And till next time, this is Real Crime Profile signing off.
If you like listening to our show and appreciate the work that Jim and Laura do and their expertise, you can do us a big favor. Please head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our pod and leave us a 5-star rating and write your thoughts about why you enjoy our show. It really, really is important and helps other people find us. Also, did you know that you can share our episode? It is so easy. On the Apple Podcast app, click the 3 dots drop down menu and you'll see an option to share to your socials or to a particular person. And then they can hear for themselves why you love listening to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for your support.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.